from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
My fellow Americans, tonight I'd like to talk with you about immigration. For more than 200 years, our tradition of welcoming immigrants from around the world has given us a tremendous advantage over other nations. It's kept us youthful, dynamic, and entrepreneurial. It has shaped our character as a people with limitless possibilities. People not trapped by our past, but able to remake ourselves as we choose. But today, our immigration system is broken. And everybody knows it.
That was U.S. President Barack Obama addressing the nation Thursday night with some of the details of his planned changes to immigration enforcement.
Now, I continue to believe that the best way to solve this problem is by working together to pass that kind of common sense law. But until that happens, there are actions I have the legal authority to take as president. The same kinds of actions taken by Democratic and Republican presidents before me that will help make our immigration system more fair and more just. Tonight, I'm announcing those actions. First, we'll build on our progress at the border with additional resources for our law enforcement personnel so that they can stem the flow of illegal crossings and speed the return of those who do cross over. Second, I'll make it easier and faster for high-skilled immigrants, graduates, and entrepreneurs to stay and contribute to our economy, as so many business leaders have proposed. Third, we'll take steps to deal responsibly with the millions of undocumented immigrants who already live in our country. The actions I'm taking are not only lawful, they're the kinds of actions taken by every single Republican president and every single Democratic president for the past half century. And to those members of Congress who question my authority to make our immigration system work better, or question the wisdom of me acting where Congress has failed, I have one answer. Pass a bill.
Republicans had harsh criticism of the president's announced plans, many even before the details were made available. This was the response of the Republican Speaker of the House, John Boehner, on Friday.
Our nation's immigration system is broken, and I think we need to work together to fix it. But at fixing it starts with a commitment to working through the democratic process and enforcing the laws that the president is sworn faithfully to execute. All year long, I've warned the president that by taking unilateral action on matters such as his health care law or by threatening action repeatedly on immigration, he was making it impossible to build the trust necessary to work together. As I warned the president, you can't ask the elected representatives of the people to trust you to enforce the law if you're constantly demonstrating that you can't be trusted to enforce the law. The president never listened. And with this action, he's refused to listen to the American people. The president has taken actions that he himself has said are those of a king or an emperor, not an American president. And he's doing this at a time when Americans want nothing more than both parties to focus on solving the biggest problems in our country, starting with our still struggling economy. And the action by the president yesterday will only encourage more people to come here illegally and putting their lives at risk. We saw the humanitarian crisis at our border last summer, how horrific it was. Well, next summer, it could be worse. And this action also punishes those who've obeyed the law and have waited their turn. With this action, the president has chosen to deliberately sabotage any chance of enacting bipartisan reforms that he claims to seek. And as I told the president yesterday, he's damaging the presidency itself.
We'll have more on this as more details of the president's plan become available. In Mexico, a day commemorating a revolution in the early 20th century may have seen the kickoff of a 21st century one. Thursday marked Mexico's Day of the Revolution, or Día de la Revolución, a national holiday that celebrates the 10-year revolution, which began with a call on November 20th, 1910, by Francisco Madero for an uprising against the then-ruling dictator, José de la Cruz Porfirio Díaz. On Thursday, more than 200 actions were carried out across the country as sparks of anger over the disappearance and apparent murder of 43 student teachers in late September ignited a flame that has brought one of the largest countries and economies in Latin America to the boiling point. Mexico has witnessed near daily nationwide actions of resistance since the disappearance of the normalistas, or student teachers, on September 28th, sparking mass marches, candlelight vigils, university and labor union strikes, occupations of official and university buildings, riot police attacks on demonstrators, destruction of official buildings, sit-ins, and international bridge closings. Thursday saw actions in every major city in the country. Organizers urged all Mexicans to refrain from working and attending school in an effort to stage a national strike. The border cities of Ciudad Juarez and El Paso sported a rare display of simultaneous cross-border resistance in holding several marches and political actions together. The two cities are the largest border metropolis in the world, where international bridge crossings were temporarily blocked by protesters. When the action was over, the demonstrators successfully demanded the free passage of hundreds of passenger vehicles that usually have to pay 26 pesos, or about $2, to cross the bridge. Thousands more protested at the official Juarez parade, while in El Paso, student groups and solidarity organizations converged in front of the Mexican consulate to protest the disappearance of the 43 students. In Tijuana, Mexico's second-largest border metropolis, a contingent consisting of high schools and the Autonomous University of Baja held a revolutionary march as an alternative to the official parade of the city. Protest leaders called for an end to state repression. After Thursday's nationwide and international resistance day ended, analysts and commentators around the world began speculating of a modern-day revolution that may be brewing in the country. As we reported yesterday, there's been no further word from the U.S. State Department about the death of an American journalist last month in Turkey. Press TV reporter Serena Shim died under mysterious circumstances a few days after she reported that Turkish intelligence forces had threatened to kill her. State Department Press Office Director Jeff Ratke had no answer on Thursday when asked about the lack of follow-up in her case by U.S. officials by RT's Gayan Chachikayan, who later filed this report.
It's been a month since the death of journalist Serena Shim in Turkey, and the investigation is still yet to release any information. On October 19th, Serena's rental car collided with a cement truck. Exactly 2 days after she claimed Turkish intelligence had accused her of spying and threatened her.
I'm very surprised at this accusation. I've even thought of actually approaching Turkish intelligence, and because I have nothing to hide and I've never done anything aside from my job, and I'd like to make that apparent to them. However, I am a bit worried because, as you know, and as the viewers know, that Turkey has been labeled by Reporters Without Borders as the largest prison for journalists. So I am a bit frightened about what they might use against me.
Turkish police say her death was an accident. We at RT have requested a comment from the Turkish authorities and are yet to receive an answer. The Office of the Representative on Freedom of the Media, the OSCE, however, told us Turkey is carrying out an investigation.
The representative has been following the case since the first reports appeared about the car accident that claimed the life of journalist Serena Shim. According to information available to her office, the Turkish authorities have started an investigation into the details of the car accident. Her office continues monitoring the case and awaits the outcome of the investigation.
Serena Shin had been actively reporting on militants being smuggled into Syria from Turkey.
I got images of them in World Food Organization trucks.
Over the past several years, Turkey has been accused of turning a blind eye to and even aiding the inflow of militants into Syria. The State Department did not even say whether they requested any information about the circumstances of Serena's death.
And you say there is no update. Why is there no update? A U.S. citizen dies days after she said she'd been threatened by the Turkish intelligence.
Well, I simply don't have any information to share at this time. I'm happy to check.
Serena was born in Michigan. She leaves behind two children, a two-year-old daughter and a four-year-old son. Her family and friends describe her as a very brave journalist. RT has obtained Serena's personal message to her mother. It was one of her final recordings.
Being killed is scary, Mom. Going to jail is not scary. It sucks, but it's not scary.
The exact circumstances of Serena's death are still unknown. They may never be known. And one of the concerns is that the U.S. may not be very eager to press on with any meaningful investigation into what happened to Serena Shim in order not to hurt relations with Turkey. In Washington, I'm Ganesh Chekyan, RT.
We will continue to follow this story. All eyes on Ferguson, Missouri, Friday, as the world awaits the grand jury's decision in the police killing of unarmed 18-year-old Michael Brown last summer. In the St. Louis region, local media reported school closings announced for next week, anticipating the release of the grand jury report, a plea for calm from small business owners, and a request by some local religious leaders who are offering their facilities to the public as refuge, should it be needed, that their houses of worship be police-free zones. Also late Friday, the ACLU of Missouri secured three federal court orders regarding citizens' right to record police. The orders, signed by U.S. District Judge John A. Ross, were in response to a motion filed by the ACLU last week. The organization had complained that authorities were still inhibiting filming of protest-related events, despite earlier court agreements with St. Louis County, Ferguson, and the Missouri Highway Patrol. Friday's court orders say the Highway Patrol and county police are, quote, permanently enjoined from enforcing a policy or custom of interfering with individuals who are photographing or recording at public places, but who are not threatening the safety of others or physically interfering with the ability of law enforcement to perform their duties, closed quote. The language reflects the earlier agreement between the parties reached on August 15th. CNN was reporting late Friday that even if the grand jury were to reach a decision before the weekend, officials could hold it back from the public until Monday. We will report back on Monday with an update of events in Ferguson. Meanwhile, in New York, another unarmed black man was shot and killed by police. RT's Maria Portnaya has the details.
According to reports, the incident occurred late Thursday evening in a Brooklyn apartment building. The 28-year-old African-American victim, Akai Gurley, was unarmed and with his girlfriend when he was fatally shot in the chest by a New York City police officer. According to reports, the cop and his partner were walking down a dimly lit stairwell when Gurley entered with his girlfriend, possibly startling the cops. Now, without warning, the New York City police officer fired one shot into Gurley's chest, sending him tumbling down two flights of stairs. The victim's girlfriend, Melissa Butler, claims that the officers didn't utter a single word or identify themselves before fatally shooting her boyfriend of 4 years in front of her eyes. After the shooting, Melissa Butler says that the officers never came down to check on her wounded boyfriend, and medical help was only sent after she banged on a neighbor's door for help. An NYPD spokesperson says there was no weapon recovered from the scene. Friends of Akai Gurley describe him as a nice man and father who doesn't carry a firearm. The NYPD says that the Internal Affairs Bureau is investigating the shooting. In the meantime, this is the latest in a string of fatal police shootings of unarmed African men. From Los Angeles and Salt Lake City to Texas and New York, dozens of unarmed black men, fathers and sons, have been shot dead by police this year. The problem has become so pervasive that it's basically considered an American epidemic. Now, of course, the incident that's garnered the most attention unfolded in Ferguson this summer when unarmed teenager Michael Brown was shot dead by a white police officer, Darren Wilson. Now, as a grand jury is currently deliberating whether to charge Wilson with that fatal shooting of Michael Brown, this latest shooting in Brooklyn may even increase the tensions that are already flaming up in Ferguson, because that is a community that is demanding accountability.
Regardless of the outcome of the grand jury in Ferguson, many activists point to the nearly daily reports of police killings of young black men as proof that serious organizing is needed. One such person is Black Agenda Radio's Bruce Dixon, who recently offered a four-part course in organizing. This is his summary of the tasks he says face organizers today.
Concerned individuals and activists in dozens of cities and towns across the nation plan to hit the streets the day after the grand jury decision is reached. Black Agenda Report is running a series of instructional primers directed at activists who want to be organizers. Activists are people who just show up, but life-changing and society-changing movements are put together quite intentionally by the people we call organizers. Organizing 101 instructed would-be organizers to always, always, always collect the names, the phone numbers, and the email addresses, the essential digits of those who turn out for any meeting, any flash mob, any demonstration of any kind. This is especially necessary if you use broadcast or social media to publicize your event, because corporate social media do not allow you to recontact anyone outside their proprietary platforms. Organizing 102 stressed the absolute necessity of emailing and calling everybody whose digits you collected back within a week or 10 days, because new friends you fail to recontact will find other things to do. Life is like that. In Organizing 103, we briefed you in the use of the volunteer card, a tried and true method of singling out the most enthusiastic of your new contacts so they can be enlisted in the callbacks, the evaluation of past activities, and the planning of new ones. The volunteer card is the first step in identifying the next layer of your movement's organizers and leaders. Today's assignment, should you choose to accept it, is Organizing 104. Organizing 104 will be a laboratory or workshop, and it will take place in your town or city the day after the St. Louis County Grand Jury verdict is issued. Your Organizing 104 assignment is to use leafleting, social media, personal networks, or whatever you've got to assemble a crowd in a public place in your city or your town the day after the grand jury verdict is announced, and carry out the procedures outlined in Organizing 101, 102, and 103. Greet everybody and pass out a sign-in sheet to get all the names, phone numbers, and email addresses in attendance, as described in Organizing 101. Identify the most enthusiastic and capable among the crowd and have them fill out volunteer cards, as explained at length in Organizing 103. Call this group of your new contacts back within the first 2 or 3 days. And within a week or 10 days, call back each and every person who showed up to thank them for participating and to invite them to a meeting to evaluate the event and to discuss future ones as described in Organizing 102. These are essential steps to real-time, real-world movement building. Successful organizers are all about the digits and the follow-up. So go back and review Organizing 101, 102, and 103 at www.blackagendareport.com and get ready to mobilize on the day after Ferguson. That's hashtag after Ferguson. This is Bruce Dixon for Black Agenda Radio.
A date was announced for the start of construction of the $50 billion Chinese-financed canal through Nicaragua, which is set to begin December 22nd, and elections in Haiti, originally set for last month, were canceled. To discuss these items and more news and events in the lands south of El Rio Grande, we go to our correspondent in the region, Tony Solo.
The big news in Nicaragua is that on the government and the private Chinese company that has undertaken to build the Interoceanic Canal have announced the beginning of work on December the 22nd.
Yep, I see.
So
that.
Work on the canal is going to start on December the 22nd, and they very seriously say that they're going to finish it in 5 years, which is, you know, an astonishing program. But I'm given the way that our construction projects are managed in China, and it's entirely plausible.
I'm curious. I'm looking at Telesur, and the piece announcing it is taking kind of a negative view of the project. Over environmental considerations.
Yeah, I'm,
what's that about?
Yeah, look, I should tell you that I have some grave reservations about the editorial policy of Telesur English. Because I don't know if you want to talk about that now. Sorry?
I'll leave that to you, because you have the agenda to get across today.
Well, but yeah, and I think it's important for people to understand that there are, in general, Telesur as a communications project is somewhat has suffers from a somewhat divided personality, because although on the one hand they want to project positive news about Venezuela and about the developments in what some people call the south of the world in a very positive way, and on the other hand they seem to be captive to capitalist Western news criteria and to capitalist Western views about what's going on in the world. And so down here in Nicaragua, I noticed that very much in the Spanish coverage. For example, it was very noticeable during the Libyan war. Somewhat less noticeable in their coverage of Syria and Iran in the Spanish version. But in the English version is very much populated by individuals who've worked very closely with Zenit, for example. They're very associated with the circle around Noam Chomsky. And whatever one thinks about, you know, Zenit or about Noam Chomsky, I think it's undeniable that they have a particular take on international affairs, and it tends to be a libertarian, quasi-anarchist take on international affairs, and that is very much reflected in Telesur's English language coverage. So, and I'm not at all surprised that you just commented that Telesur English is suggesting that there are environmental, negative environmental concerns around the canal, because that has been the standard Western
argument,
NATO and NATO fellow traveler view of the canal.
You know, and they're burying the lead in this piece too. It starts out the controversial, that's what they call it, canal will run through Lake Nicaragua, other sensitive ecosystems, and will have adverse effects for many communities. And then it does five paragraphs of that, and then it says, oh, by the way, according to government officials, the canal is expected to double Nicaragua's GDP, which is considered Latin America's second poorest country.
And I think that's a very fair reflection, Don, of the bias of the people around Zenit, the people around Chomsky, who have populated Telesur English.
I'm not
surprised by that at all. You know, and if you look at the position of Zenit and Chomsky way back in 2011, it seems like ancient history now, but it was only 3 years ago. And the around the war in Libya, and their positions were what they were, and I interpret those positions from a very negative point of view. I disagree with them deeply.
Yeah, me too.
And the other thing that I remember about the folks in Zenit and about the North American neo-colonial left in general is that in 2008, in the municipal elections in Nicaragua, and subsequent to those elections, there was a vicious right-wing campaign against the Nicaraguan government, alleging electoral fraud in those municipal elections.
Right.
Zenit published articles very much in line with that right-wing campaign, which eventually led to the suspension of a total of around $100 million of foreign aid from Western Europe and North America to Nicaragua.
Right.
You know, so in terms of, and that's my take. You know,
they did it twice in this article, because buried under that is the real news. There's another paragraph. An advisor to Ortega says there's nothing else in Nicaragua that could achieve, talking about doubling the GDP, that could achieve that within our lifetimes, and it's within grasp. So he says that.
Yeah.
Then buried under that, construction of the $50 billion project is expected to take 5 years, and it's being financed by the Chinese. The fact that China is investing $50 billion in Nicaragua is not the newsworthy thing. And the fact that this project is going to double the GDP of Nicaragua isn't the newsworthy thing. Instead, it's they don't specify, by the way, the environmental impacts that it's going to have. And
well,
it says that some people
they can't specify the environmental impact because they don't know.
Right.
And because the environmental studies have yet to be published. But one of the crucial things about the environmental argument is that the environmentalists, the neo-colonial environmentalist community in North America and Western Europe, talk about Nicaragua as though it's some kind of unspoiled environmental paradise.
Right.
But that is not the case. In fact, Nicaragua for the last 20-30 years has suffered severe deforestation. Why? As a result of poverty.
Right.
And so the advance, all these people who are expressing concern about in the West about, you know, what's going to happen to Nicaragua's environment. Well, where was their concern prior to the announcement of the canal, when Nicaragua's environment was already under severe pressure as a result of the effects of poverty and the advance of the agricultural frontier, threatening in particular the Mesoamerican biological corridor that runs down Nicaragua's Caribbean coast?
Which this will actually support. The infrastructural projects, the drainage, and all the other things that are going to go along with this are actually going to protect huge parts of the environment from the damage of both global warming and just the weather and the situation, you know, being situated between two oceans. It's fragile.
Yeah, and that's very much the argument of the government. I mean, are they right or are they wrong? Well, we don't know for sure, but it's a discussion that should be had, and one can't have that discussion because the environmentalists refuse to have it. They refuse to acknowledge that there's already an environmental crisis in Nicaragua. They refuse to engage in a discussion about, well, what are we going to do about this existing environmental crisis? Well, is the canal a legitimate solution? You can't even have that discussion because they've already made up their minds.
Go
and
to
that
Africa.
Gives you that, in my opinion, that gives you a very clear view of how seriously we should take the protestations of these environmentalists when they say that they're talking about democracy and open debate.
Oh,
because they shut down debate.
Yeah. Listen, go to Africa. You'll find how many NGOs preaching all of that and defending, elephants and all kinds of, native life, animal life there. And while they're doing it, they'll stay in a town where there's maybe 1,000 children starving to death. And that's not on their radar.
Well, and they're all those arguments around that kind of mentality, aren't there, Dawn? But I mean, the nitty-gritty for people here in Nicaragua and for people in the rest of Latin America is that the kinds of opinions expressed by the Western neocolonial left are irrelevant.
Right.
And people aren't looking over their shoulder to see what Noam Chomsky thinks. You know, and when the Movimiento Sin Tierra in Brazil, or when people in Honduras in the Bajo Aguan go and occupy land to be able to feed their families, they aren't looking over their shoulder at what people like the folks around Zine or Counterpunch or Dissident Voice or any of those think. They're doing what they've got to do in accordance with their immediate, decisive interests,
right.
and that's what they're going to do, and that's why. And when Latin America, when you look at Latin America and you see the governments are freeing themselves from the dominance of the policies of the United States government and the policies of the governments of the European Union, they aren't just liberating themselves from the policies of those governments. They're liberating themselves from the whole discourse of the West, left or right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you look at what's happening in Telesur, what you're seeing is a kind of residue, a kind of leftover from Latin American dependence on what the West thinks.
Mm. You know, there's a just a sidetrack, and then we'll jump into the business at hand. There's a BRICS conference going on in Beijing right now. And yesterday, CCTV, the Chinese news outlet, one of the reporters, Hong Pan, spoke with Georgi Telolayo, who's the executive director of the Russian National Committee on BRICS, and he's the head of the Russian delegation to this conference. And he said the primary issue before them is the fact that the entire global system tilts to the West, and they have to correct that. That's the same thing here.
And we're in the middle of that process, aren't we, Tom?
Yeah,
I mean, and you yourself have your own life experience of that process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I do too, and the many many people like us. So, it's a process.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.